Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This hour, a University of Washington astronomer will tell you how she fell in love with the night sky and with the book A Wrinkle in Time. First, our top story. How do we diversify the tech sector? So far, it's been a struggle to get more women, more people of color into software development and computer science. In 2015, women made up just 18% of all computer science degrees. One of my next guests says that might be the best we can expect. Stuart Regis is principal lecturer in computer science and engineering at the University of Washington. He wrote in an article last week that women are underrepresented because of personal preferences, not systemic forces. Stuart is in our studio with Nicole Buchanan. She trains women and gender-diverse people in software development at Ada Developers Academy in Seattle. Welcome to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Stuart, how did you come to write this essay, this post?
Well, I was motivated by what I saw with James Damore. I think that
this
I
is
was
the Google engineer.
The Google engineer.
Who was fired shortly after his opinionating.
Yeah, I kind of knew that we were doing more in the diversity area with things like a workshop we'd gotten from Google called Bias Busters.
Who's this? UW Computer Science?
Yeah, the computer science. And so I started looking at it more closely. And the closer I looked at it, the less I liked it. So I had kind of concerns about what we were doing. And I've spent the last 10 months talking to people, and I've been rather surprised by what I've found, you know, that there's a level of intolerance. When I ask the question of whether diversity should include someone like Damore.
You wrote, for one thing, Stuart, that the percentages of women in computer sciences, you think it's about where it's ever going to be. Is that right?
That was my personal prediction. That's my honest opinion.
Why do you think that?
Well, we've been working really hard. I think we've done a lot of things along the way to address issues that have been there, discrimination against women. We've hit a kind of a plateau that we don't seem to be making further progress.
And why do you think that is?
Well, my explanation in my article is that I think it has to do with choice. I think that women are able to do computer science, but a lot of them are just choosing to do other things instead.
And why do you think that choice is happening?
I quoted a paper that, a couple of papers actually, that looked at this question. The most recent one was talking about the fact that, people who have high math ability and high verbal ability don't tend to go into STEM careers as much as people who have high math and medium verbal ability. So if you're good at both math and verbal, you don't tend to go into STEM. And that's disproportionately women.
Okay. Nicole Buchanan, you read Stuart's article. You're listening to him talk. What do you think about his take that female representation in computer science is what it is because of free choice?
So I don't agree with Stuart. So I don't believe it's ultimately an idea of free choice. I don't believe it could be an idea of free choice if you weren't provided access or the ability to have access to be able to make a choice. If a lot of these folks from marginalized communities, not just women, but from all different types of communities, if you're not provided access, and so we're talking about women, if you haven't had the ability to be exposed to these things at an early age, it's not a free choice issue. It's an access issue.
Stuart, how do you react to Nicole saying it's not a matter of free choice? Different groups are not exposed to the choice.
One of the sections that I had in my article was, it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
And I suspect that if Nicole and I talked about this for many hours, we'd come to the conclusion it's complicated.
It is.
You know, and I think that her organization is doing great work. I think it's wonderful that you're trying to get women into this field. Mm-hmm. And I work on this too, you know, that I'm trying to get women interested in computer science. But I guess I feel that there are these studies and indications. I mean, I'll mention just a couple of things. The PISA study that came out this year that the Atlantic Monthly had an interesting article about talked about the fact that there are a lot of girls mm-hmm. who are very good at math and science, but they're even better at reading. And there's kind of evidence that people tend to pursue the thing that they perceive themselves as being best at. And so, you know, it's an indication that they're not necessarily likely to do STEM. And the other interesting point I'll make is just that it was more extreme in the countries that have the highest gender equality. So kind of they had a nice graph that kind of showed that the more we achieve, they call this a paradox. The more we achieve gender equality, the fewer women we see going into STEM.
Yeah, but you know what? I think people can put graphs and charts on paper to define the narrative in whatever direction, quite frankly, that you want the narrative to go in. And generally, I would say girls can be great at math and science and even better at reading and excel at coding. When you live in this world and you work with as many women and gender diverse folks as I have, and I see it and live it and breathe it, I mean, I know.
Well, Nicole, will you give us an example of how someone doesn't have the free choice, that they have barriers that you think Stuart's not acknowledging to getting into tech?
It's pretty simple. I mean, if you go into some areas of the country and you go into some marginalized communities where folks have no idea, quite frankly, no idea what a computer even can do, have, you know, they have no idea what software development. If you say that word, and I have gone into a community and talked to young kids, young African-American kids, and say to them, I run a software development school. And they say to me, what is software development? They have no idea what software is. That just tells you. And so you can't tell me that it's a choice issue for a bunch of young girls, young nine-year-olds, that I say, hey, you know, I do software development. And they say to me, what is software development?
Well, let me say, I think that I have not tried to say anything about groups outside of women. Mm-hmm. So I think that, for example, if you talk about blacks, Hispanics, this is a very complicated issue that I do not understand well. And I think we've spent a lot of time trying to do better with women, and we have done better with women. Mm-hmm. We find it much harder, you know, to make progress with underrepresented minorities. I feel like the issue with women is less complicated because I feel that by and large, they've had good academic preparation. They've had a lot of math. They've kind of come in. You know, well, that's why we've been so successful, I think, as we have.
We spoke with a former student of yours, Casey Champion, software engineer at Microsoft, part-time lecturer at the UW. And she said, you have done great work, Stuart. But even Casey Champion, this was her reaction to your talking about, you said, don't attribute to oppression that which can be explained by free choice. Mm-hmm. And Casey reacted to this idea that women have a free choice of whether to go into computer science.
Like the idea that, like, oh, if we just, like, give every woman the opportunity to really make the choice, then it's just completely free choice from there on out, which is just absolute ridiculousness, because there are so many things that go into somebody's life and their societal influences that lead them to make those choices. And it just sort of breaks our heart that he has such a superficial understanding of it, that he could just say, oh, well, if I do everything in my classroom to just make it a safe place, then we've solved the problem. And that's just unfortunately not true.
And Stuart, this is a fan of yours.
Well, we can disagree, right? I mean, I think that nationwide, we get around 20% women in computer science. We get closer to 30% at the University of Washington because I think we've addressed a lot of these things. We're not doing better than 30%. We're not really going above that number. It leads me to feel that there's something bigger going on than just addressing some of these structural issues.
Nicole, what do you think?
I think those structural issues are, as Casey says, I mean, they're embedded. They come from fathers and brothers and uncles. We hear it all the time. I have students that come through ADA that have gone to the University of Washington, that have gotten degrees, that have gotten master's degrees at the University of Washington and had great first careers. Some of them ended up working at the University of Washington and then ended up at ADA's doorsteps, right? Because at some point they were told computer science was not the way to go. That's not a career for you. You know, you should really look at something else. Or they actually went into computer science and did that for the first year and said they didn't feel that they were in an environment that was welcoming. They felt disrespected. One person said she felt belittled in the entire first year of being a CS student. She didn't have any female models, and she felt that every time that there was an encounter with the professor. She felt that he was belittling her. She felt, you know what, I don't want to have to put up with this. And if I have to put up with this, and this is what a career is going to feel like, I don't want to do this.
Stuart, does that sound like free choice?
In that case, no.
We get a lot of that.
I mean, I'm not saying that these things don't happen. I mean, mm-hmm. we dealt with that at the University of Washington.
Yeah.
I think that it was really amazing to see that the change that messaging can make. I feel like in the early years, the biggest problem was not having a critical mass, you know, mm-hmm. and then there are these feelings that, like, I'm the only woman in this room, you know. So I think that kind of going from around 13% women to around 20% women was the hardest. Mm. And then it got a little easier as you went along, because now maybe there are two women in the room instead of one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Part of it, too, is I just find it surprising that people can't accept the possibility that we don't necessarily get to 50-50. I mean, it may just be that women and men have different preferences. What if it ends up at 30? You know, so in my article, I was saying 20. What if it ends up at 30? Even that, I think, is unacceptable to a lot of the people. You're saying, till we get to 50-50. But why do we have to get to 50-50?
I don't think anyone is saying it has to get to 50-50. I think what people are vying for is that there is equal opportunity and equity given to folks within the workplace specifically, that there is an opportunity to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, Stuart, you said women are less likely to choose computer science. And why do you think that is? Are you saying there is a biological component, a biological lack of either aptitude or inclination toward computer science? What do you think is going on?
You know, this is what got DeMore into so much trouble, was that he wanted to talk about biology and fixed differences. In my article, I actually quoted the diversity advocates that, you know, we talk all the time about differences between men and women, that women have different values, they bring different strengths. If you think that diverse teams are stronger because women bring things to the team that men don't, that must be because there are differences, you know.
And are you targeting cultural difference, biological difference? What is your theory?
I don't think I need a theory.
Wouldn't a solution depend on identifying the problem?
Well, so if you think about the question of whether, I mean, even if it's a social construct, it'll take us 20 years to reprogram the next generation of children to have a different, you know, different set of social outcomes. There's a great article that a woman named Megan McArdle wrote, you know, when the Damore case broke. And she talked about how she'd been working in tech. And she told a funny story about how she was having a trouble with her relationship, and she went in on Monday and was telling people as she spent her weekend dealing with this, and they all just kind of stared at her blankly, all these men. They had no comment. And then one of them said, I spent the weekend working on this really geeky programming thing. And they were like, oh, they all wanted to talk about that. And she said that that was the moment when she realized that that was not where she wanted to spend her life. She said, these are not my people. That was the title of her article. These are not my people. And she went off and did a different career. She's a journalist. She, you know, I think that she's had a great career that she enjoys. Yeah.
Stuart, why should someone feel alienated from an important and lucrative field because they feel like these are not my people? Do you want computer science schools and companies to make themselves places where women no longer say, these aren't my people, I can't work here?
Well, I think if there are things that you can do, that would be good to do. I think that there's a question of, is that really the big issue? You know, are there things that companies haven't done that they need to do?
I think there are.
So this is a point of disagreement. It's kind of, I think that these things matter, but I think that the choice issue matters more.
Yeah, see, and I would disagree, because I think they're extremely significant, and I don't think it's just things that companies should do. I think it's things that we all should do to allow more folks to get into this field.
What could we do? What should we do?
I think one of the things that I read, and I completely agree with this, is one of the things that I feel women align with and understand a little bit better is really knowing kind of what a career can be for them and what an industry or what a STEM career can develop or lead to. And sometimes that's a little unclear with respect to CS or engineering, where becoming a physician or becoming a veterinarian or right. And so that's really clear cut. I know what I'm going to do. I want to help people. I want to heal people. And I know how to do that with this career. You can do that with CS, right? And so maybe what we can do is be better at allowing people to understand how they can do that.
Stuart, any objection?
No, not at all. No, I think these are all great ideas. We have a great group of people at University of Washington that do mm-hmm. this kind of thing.
And how do we do that earlier? Because by the time you get to university sure. stage, by the time you get to college stage, maybe you've already made a choice. Again, back to the choice issue
yeah.
and access issue. If we're starting to provide access to girls and youth,
sure.
Right?
You know, and code.org does a lot of great programs. There's a new AP exam called Computer mm-hmm. Science Principles
yeah.
that's trying to get at this. So there's a lot of work that's being done. And, you know, it's possible that 5 or 10 years from now, I'll have to admit that I was totally wrong.
I'm hoping. I think you are.
I'm hoping too.
I really am. Yeah.
You know, because I'd like to see more women in computer science. I've seen a lot of women who end up loving it. And it, you know, it actually pains me to see women who have a talent for it, who say, I just am going to go off and do this other thing.
Right.
You know, we started with Stuart expresses opinions, and is that okay? And is this an okay conversation to have? And does this feel helpful? What do you think of Stuart expressing his thoughts and the conversation we had today, Nicole?
You know, people have a right to their opinion, and people have a right to disagree. As you said, this issue is complicated. And I don't think that you have looked at the depths of the complication. And when you're involved and interacting with women and gender diverse folks and you experience what they experience on a day to day, it's really hard to just look at a piece of paper and go, yeah, staying at 30% is comfortable and okay. And when I see an article like this, this is dangerous to me because this is saying 30% is okay. And we stop right here.
My hope would be that we can have conversations like this, that we can have respect for each other, learn from each other, that everyone can express their honest opinions, and that it can generate useful discussions the way we've had a useful discussion today.
We must pause it there. Stuart Regis, Nicole Buchanan, thank you for sitting in this. I appreciate this conversation.
Thanks for having us.
Nicole Buchanan trains women and gender diverse people in software development at Ada Developers Academy in Seattle. And Stuart Regis is principal lecturer in computer science and engineering at the University of Washington. And here's the university's response to Regis's article. Hank Levy, the director of the UW's Paul G. Allen School of Computer Science and Engineering, issued a memo to the Allen School community. It says the school disagrees with the essay's conclusions. Quote, we do not believe that where we are today is the best we are likely to achieve. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. When the book A Wrinkle in Time came out 50 years ago, it was the first time a lot of young girls saw themselves in a story that was so much about science. Remember the quantum physics and the tesseract? The book opened up the universe to generations of young women, including University of Washington Assistant Professor of Astronomy Emily Levesque. When the movie version came out in March, Levesque came to our studio and told me about her love for the cosmos.
I think I knew I wanted to be an astronomer when I was about 2 years old.
2 years old?
Yes. I was 2 years old in 1986, which was the last time Halley's Comet made its close pass by Earth.
Uh-huh.
I have a brother who's 10 years older than me, and he was asked to observe the comet for a school project. So he and I and my parents all went traipsing out into the backyard, and apparently I was just fascinated by the night sky. So after that, people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I'd say, oh, I'm going to be a ballerina or an astronomer, or I'm going to be a firefighter or an astronomer, and astronomer's what stuck.
What do you think it was that stuck with you, whereas my kids don't think about constellations as much as they used to?
I think I just got curious. I think the little kid curiosity that everybody has focused on the night sky very early for me, and then my parents fed it with reading and with books.
Which brings us to Wrinkle in Time. How did that book come into your life?
I read that book for the first time when I was about 8 years old. I was an early reader and a really enthusiastic reader, and my mom is a children's librarian, so she was constantly trying to find books that were challenging for me to read but weren't at a maturity level above an eight-year-old. And A Wrinkle in Time was perfect for that. So she gave that book to me, and I just devoured it and loved it and read it and reread it over and over.
What did you love about A Wrinkle in Time?
I loved that it was a book about science and that it was a book that was using physics as a tool for exploring the universe. I loved that it featured kids who were interested in science and who maybe were a little bit different. And that difference and that love for science actually wound up powering the story and really being a driving force and making them protagonists. I thought that was so cool.
Yes, Meg is the main character, and she's kind of awkward and, right? She's struggling.
Yeah, she has glasses, which I identified with as a kid. She is not popular in school. She butts heads with her teachers and her peers and is just seen as odd and this troublesome kid. And in reality, she just works in a different way. And I think as somebody who got teased in school for being the kid interested in science, it was so awesome to see a character like that as a hero.
You could relate to Meg?
Yes, very much so.
We should probably describe the plot just lightly for people who don't know the book and now the movie.
Yeah, so the storyline starts with Meg and her younger brother, Charles Wallace. And when it opens, we learn that their father is a scientist who has disappeared several years ago. And their mother, who is also a scientist, is assuring them, well, he's away for something related to his research. I'm sure he'll be back. And they're wondering what's become of him. And Charles Wallace introduces these three sort of mystical beings into their lives, Mrs. What's-It, Mrs. Who, and Mrs. Which.
Mm-hmm.
And they wind up taking the children on this journey through the universe to find and rescue their father, and the story spirals from there.
I read it when I was very young. I read parts of it to my daughter a couple of years ago. I didn't realize the science was so important. These creatures, they're flying around, and they used to be stars, and to me, it might as well have been Glinda the Good Witch floating on a bubble, but it's actually quite scientific.
Well, the core science of the book and the mechanism they use to travel through the universe actually is rooted in physics. The main thing that we hear about in the book is something called a tesseract.
Right.
And they describe that as how they travel through the universe. And it invokes this idea that space-time as we know it is four-dimensional. That's how we're used to seeing it. There's the three dimensions that we can see and touch, and then there's the fourth dimension, which is time. The Tesseract makes use of the idea that there's a fifth dimension and that you can wrinkle space-time into that extra dimension, and it's like folding up a piece of paper or bending a string, which is the little hand-drawn illustration they show in the book. And by doing that, you can travel between points in the universe that appear to be great distances apart. It's close to what we would think of today as a wormhole. Anyone who's actually seen the movie Interstellar has seen examples of using something like that to travel through the universe.
I'm talking with Assistant Professor of Astronomy at the UW, Emily Levesque. We're talking about A Wrinkle in Time, and I wonder the book and now the movie. Do you find that literature has informed the way you think of your astronomy work?
Oh, very much so. I read A Wrinkle in Time when I was very young. I read Carl Sagan when I was young. And there are many writers who do a wonderful job of synthesizing science and the art of literature. It's funny because I sometimes hate the idea that there are creative and artsy people and there are science and math people, and they're very separate things. Because in my experience, there's so much overlap there. Being able to verbalize and explain the science that we do is such a crucial part of scientists' day-to-day lives. And the creativity that comes to bear in writing is also so important for doing science. You need to be able to think of creative ways of looking at data or creative ways of asking questions. So I think that these two things are very tightly connected.
So why do we have that idea of the mathematician or the scientist as the uncreative wonk?
I don't know. I think that part of it comes from the idea that these things have been taught separately. And for a long time in school, the subjects were treated separately. And we're now hearing about things like STEAM, so science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. And hopefully that's changing. And communicating science can be very challenging. We are, as scientists, used to thinking of a lot of concepts in terms of numbers and equations or mental visuals. And I actually love the exercise of trying to explain it very plainly, but it's hard. And it's a skill that I know a lot of scientists now are placing even more priority on.
In A Wrinkle in Time, there's the idea we meet three beings who used to be stars, right? They kind of chose to stop being stars and fight the darkness, something like that?
Yes. In the book, Mrs. Wetzet actually talks about this, that she was a star who, I think the depiction is, she sort of exploded or died this very luminous death to fight a darkness that's encroaching on the universe.
Yes. And meanwhile, you discovered three stars, the three largest stars in the known universe. You discovered those as an undergrad?
Yes. I discovered those during research that I did while I was an undergrad at MIT. Yeah.
That's amazing. And do you see any connection between these stars in A Wrinkle in Time and your discovery?
I actually think that I would not have been involved in that project and would not have discovered those stars if it hadn't been for A Wrinkle in Time, because when I read A Wrinkle in Time, it immediately sucked me into this idea of traveling through the universe and tesseracts and bending space, which in astronomy leads you directly to black holes. So even when I was starting my undergraduate career, I was fascinated by the idea of black holes. And I got very curious about how we make this transition from stars that are massive, but perhaps otherwise not that weird, to these objects that they form after they die, like black holes. So after my sophomore year of college, I got the chance to work with an astronomer named Philip Massey at Lowell Observatory, which is in Flagstaff, Arizona. And he offered me two different research projects and asked me to pick one. And one was working on blue supergiant stars, and the other was working on red supergiants. It sounds like a really superficial difference, but I knew that blue supergiants were very young, newly born stars, and red supergiants were very evolved stars that were getting ready to die and possibly make black holes. So I picked that project almost on a whim, going, it's closer to black holes, I'll like it. And those stars, by definition, are enormous. So working on that project is how we wound up discovering the three largest stars that anybody had seen in the universe. And I wouldn't have picked that project if I hadn't had this long-seated fascination with black holes.
And A Wrinkle in Time was part of that.
Very much so.
You mentioned that a thing about the book that stands out is that math and science doesn't seem to have anything to do with gender. You know, Meg is excellent at math. Her father is a scientist. Her mother is a brilliant scientist. When you were growing up in the 80s, you said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was it common for girls to get that message?
I think that it was not as common as it should have been. I think I was very lucky in that as I was growing up, my family never treated me like a girl who liked science and never made an issue of my gender. I was a kid who liked science and who was interested in astronomy and digging for dinosaur bones in the backyard. And I think that lack of emphasis helped me just be a kid and just be a scientist. And I like seeing that reflected now when I go back and read the book, that there are clearly scientists in the book whose gender is not a factor. I think when I read it as a kid, I was mostly interested in Meg and her little brother. But now I see how nice it is that there was this brilliant woman scientist who was also a mom and who was just simply there and is a linchpin of the story, that I think in retrospect, it's good to have a character like that present and sort of showing readers, yep, it's completely normal to grow up and be a scientist regardless of gender.
And what kind of messages do you see kids getting today?
I hope that they're getting that message louder and clearer. I think that the fact that this movie has been made will help that. I think kids seeing other kids like themselves on screen and seeing that an interest in science is wonderful and should be nourished is a wonderful message.
There's also the element of Meg that is non-conforming. The book is very much about conformity too.
Yes.
She's stubborn, and the evil force kind of wants you to conform with the big mind.
Yeah, I think I might have, as a kid, identified with her not conforming at least as much as I did with her gender.
Yeah.
Because I liked that she was not a perfect character. She's not always brave, and she can be mouthy, and she can have a bit of an attitude. And those are all, I think, really familiar to anybody who's ever been 13. And seeing that that just made her a whole person really made me like her as a character. It avoided the message that we can sometimes give of you have to be perfect to grow up to be what you want to be. And it doesn't say, you know, don't try to fix things and improve, but it says be who you are wholly. Don't try to fit into this very narrow profile of what a woman can be or what a scientist can be.
Yeah, when I was a kid, a big book to read was Heidi. Have you ever heard of that book?
Oh, yes.
And Heidi is also, you know, is the happy one and the prevailing one, but boy, is she a, she's perfect, but also kind of a take care of other people type of person. And some of us are caretakers, but some of us aren't always.
So something that struck me when I was watching the movie in particular is it's so nice to see a fully realized character like that. I mean, the actress who plays Meg in the movie, Storm Reid, she's just wonderful. And you get the full mix of characters from her. She's not just a girl. She's not just a scientist. She can be upset. She can be ecstatically happy. She can be scared. A couple of weeks ago, I also went to see Black Panther and the character of Shuri. I felt like there were so many connections between her and Meg. And it's not just that they're both young women of color, and it's not both that they're brilliant scientists. They have sometimes butting heads in relationships with the other adults in their lives. They're fiercely protective of their brothers. They're interested in science. They have a little bit of mischief in them. And seeing these characters realized as people and full complex characters, I think makes them click more with anybody watching who's thinking, oh, I'm stubborn like that. Or sometimes people pick on me for that. And it just makes them more vivid role models.
Talking about A Wrinkle in Time, and now a couple more questions for Assistant Professor of Astronomy at UW, Emily Levesque. One is, if you could wave a magic wand over our current science culture, what would you change?
That's a great question. One thing that I've always wanted to do is get as many people excited about science as possible. And I think that that's more than just showing somebody a cool image from Hubble or showing them a snippet of how science works. I want everybody to understand why we do the research that we do, how the research is done, because there are fascinating stories, even within astronomy, of how people use telescopes and make discoveries. I really want to bring back or bring to the forefront the idea that science is done by people and by humans, and that this passion and curiosity is really what's driving scientists. So much of that directly creates the types of discoveries that we make, and having more understanding of that, having as a result more financial support for science, is only going to sort of help how science is done and really help humanity.
Yeah, so depict science as the human story that it is. It's not just gears turning.
Yes.
Which brings us back to A Wrinkle in Time. I'd like to know what you thought of the movie.
I just went to go see it, and I knew going in that it was going to be very different than the image that I had in my mind. I'd actually talked to some people who were saying, oh, I don't know if I want to go see it. I pictured it so differently.
And I've heard that.
I was actually really excited for that, because everybody has their own picture of a book in their head when they go to see a movie. And I was really excited to see something different. The book itself, as you read it, is really cerebral. It spends time, in some cases, very literally inside people's minds.
Yes.
And obviously, a movie has to use different tools of storytelling, and the approach that was taken here was so richly visual that it was fascinating to see this colorful world on screen, see depictions of the different planets that they visit. It was just so wild to see the version of the book that had come out of the directors and the creative team's heads. And there was an amazing attention to detail within the movie, where you could really tell that it had come from people who read and loved the book.
Oh, that's good to hear.
There's a scene when the children first arrive on Kamazots, which is this planet that is for lack of a better word, it's sort of controlled by a hive mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in this very creepy, perfect, programmed suburb. And
the kids are bouncing the red balls.
Exactly. It's a scene in the trailer. And if you listen when you watch the movie, there's a dog barking and a bird chirping in the background. And they are on a loop.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same bark and the same chirp every time. And those little details are clearly put in there by a team that read that scene, and it made as much of an impression on them as it did on other readers, and they wanted to pass that creepy, this isn't quite right feeling onto viewers.
Did the science survive?
The science actually is a bit changed in the movie. They invoke a different mechanism for how tesseracts work, but there's some really nice science in there. The very opening scene is a younger Meg and her dad using something called a Chladni plate, which is a pretty classic physics demonstration where you put sand on a plate and then vibrate it at different frequencies. And the resonant frequencies of the plate give you these amazing patterns as the sand on the plate settles into sort of still regions. And they combine that and the idea of quantum entanglement to explain the tesseract, which is very different from the book, but I think makes for some really great visuals because, again, it's a visual medium. So you want something that you can depict for an audience in a very vivid way.
I don't suppose you would give it 3 stars. How many stars?
I don't think I want to give it a star rating. I think that I want people to go see it as its own creative entity and then hopefully read the book as well and get these two different versions of a really great story.
Emily Levesque, assistant astronomy professor, University of Washington, discoverer of the 3 largest stars in the known universe. I hope that all scientists and children and grown-ups share the love of story that you clearly have. I just love listening to you.
Oh, thank you. I try to do this when I talk about my own research, any type of science. People respond to stories and respond to storytelling. So you want to depict that science as a story. I've had people tell me that some of the research that we do sounds like a mystery novel where you ask a question and you go seek out the answer, but that really is what it is.
Emily Levesque, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you.
And Dr. Levesque goes into much more detail about how the book A Wrinkle in Time inspired her in an upcoming podcast called The Deep, produced by Moment Magazine. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle.
KUOW's The Record continues now, and coming up next, a conversation with New Yorker poetry editor Kevin Young. This was recorded in 2017.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Fake news, right? We've all heard that phrase. One way the White House is attacking the press, and you have media organizations from CNN to The Washington Post pushing back and saying, wait, no, journalists hold powerful people accountable. We verify our reporting before publishing. Well, our next guest says, be careful who you rely on for truth. And historically, the media haven't always been so reliable. Archivist Kevin Young is the author of the new book, Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. Kevin, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me.
You started writing this book 6 years ago.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think about these attacks on the media in the 2016 presidential campaign and up to today?
Well, I started with thinking about hoaxes historically and how in the 19th century they started with Barnum and people like that thinking about, in a way, some of the same questions as we have today about
P.T. Barnum?
Yeah, about how could America be great, you know, thinking about our connection to, in his case, George Washington and the Founding Fathers. And, you know, I trace it up to today and thinking about the ways that some of these same divides that I think the hoax makes use of are at play today and in our fake news. And one of them happens to be race, I think. But also, I think that the fake news really is part of this larger trend that I trace in the book of are hoaxes more frequent now and are they worse? And I think they are. And I think the past year or so has shown us the ways in which not only are there hoaxes being pushed out, but even our election last year had these effects of bots and things that played on these very same things of race and divide and sought to divide us further, I think.
I do want to talk about hoaxes and race. First, I was referring to the mainstream media.
Sure.
And are you also saying that even the news that we're used to thinking of as reliable is less reliable and always has been than we think?
No, I do think that technology affects the hoax and affects fakery, you know, and it can make it somewhat easier. But I also think that the internet and journalists catch hoaxes. You know, they're the way you saw that in the Washington Post story this week, where someone was trying to fake against the Roy Moore story and you know, corrupt sort of the idea of sources.
This was the woman who went to the Washington Post claiming she, I think she had been
assaulted,
raped and then and had an abortion and all about this candidate Roy Moore.
Yeah, I mean, and these were fake, yeah. And the journalists took, you know, did what journalists do, I think, and caught it. I don't think journalism, you know, I do trace fake journalist stories and specific fakery, but I really trace it to the people who did it. What's, I think, important to keep in mind is that journalists catch journalists, and the internet catches internet hoaxes, and I don't want to take a strong position and say that, hey, these people are to blame. I think it's more complicated than that. This is the media we've created, and in some ways we've bought and sometimes believe in, and I want to understand why.
What is it about the hoax that you think is a major theme in American life?
Well, you know, starting with Barnum, I think the hoax really did speak to these questions of what it meant to be an American, what it meant to be a person now. And, you know, Barnum, his first hoax was about George Washington. It was featured a black woman who he claimed was George Washington's nursemaid, which would have made her 161 years old, which he advertised. And then, you know, that wasn't true, of course, but people want to see her. You know, they wanted this connection to the founding father of our nation. And I think hoaxes became a way to understand what it meant to be a young nation. And then as we went,
What do you mean by that? How did hoaxes help us understand?
I know it's ironic, right, that a hoax would help you kind of establish your bona fide. Or, you know, but that was very much what the hoax did. You know, like in England, people would find a Shakespeare play, which they made up, you know, as a way to say, hey, you know, Shakespeare is important. We're important. You know, this is a way of kind of honoring one's past and nation. And I think that Barnum,
you didn't have actual connections to the foundations of your civilization, but
you could
make sort of fake your way toward it.
Well, and also it's a way of saying Shakespeare is so important now that he's worthy of faking. Right. We want more Shakespeare, you know, and I think right now, some of the divisions that Barnum played with, later he showed a man, a black man, he called What Is It in 1860, and this was just a year after Origin of the Species, but he promoted this figure as the missing link, you know, and so these hoaxes have long played on questions of race, but also questions of origin and where we come from and who are we. And
why? What does race have to do with the hoax?
Well, both of those figures were black.
Yeah.
You know?
Why do you think that? But you think that that's not a coincidence. So
No. I trace it all the way into sort of the fake Indians from the start of our republic, whether that was the Boston Tea Party, till now, where you see there were some uncovered this last summer of people pretending to be Native American. I talk about Rachel Dolezal, who is a
Washington state's own.
Correct. And I think she's an interesting figure because just a week after she was uncovered.
Will you explain who she is for those
who
don't know?
She was a woman who was white by birth and pretended to be black and darkened her skin and changed her hair.
And she's in Spokane, an NAACP leader.
Yeah, yeah. Lucky you all, you know. Mm-hmm. she then was caught and, you know, outed, as it were. And then what was interesting is then, I mean, troubling, I'd say, a week later, the Charleston shooting happened. And in my book, I try to think about this connection between the two. What's it mean that they happen within a week of each other? And to me, both of those figures, the Charleston shooter and Dolezal, misunderstand blackness, you know, and they see in it trauma and pain. And one sort of seeks to sort of join it and promote it, and the other seeks to kind of eliminate it or see it as inflict more. And I tried to understand the way that this connection with race went all the way back to Barnum and, you know, preys on our deep divisions. That I think, you know, your other guests were talking a little bit about the threats to these kind of very things that only seem to be increasing.
I imagine this nursemaid who's supposed to be 160 years old, how long did she tour with this show?
Well, she toured till she died, actually, and she probably died of exposure. We think she was probably enslaved. We know she had been, but we think that Barnum had purchased her. It's a little muddy there. You know, and Barnum was clever. He would take her one place, which Providence, where she was, which was a free state, and, you know, he wanted, like, he would really focus on her liberation, and then you take her somewhere else and sort of say, you know, who knows what, where she's from and how she served. So he really played both aspects. And then when she died, he autopsied her in a medical theater and charged admission, which is just a troubling kind of end. But I think also thinks about the stakes, which are life and death for this kind of fakery.
And why is there something about racial attitudes in this country that play into a hoax like that?
Well, I almost think it's the other way around. I came to think by the end that race was a kind of hoax, that it too was a fake thing pretending to be real, which means it had real effects, you know? There's a lot of hoaxes built on race, but also race plays into a lot of hoaxes, plays off them. Sometimes in literal ways and sometimes in more elaborate ones, but always there's this returning to that. And I really sought to understand why. Why do we sort of believe the worst of each other, which is another sort of quality I think the hoax has gotten only worse at. You know, now, it used to be even in the stories I'm telling you of Barnum, they were at least kind of honorific. You know, it's like, hey, this who is this person? And they let viewers believe they could be an expert in something. You know, they could choose themselves. It was almost a democratic principle. And now I think there are no experts. We're in a time where experts are looked down on and they're seen as somehow a liability. Barnum at least faked doctors. Now we don't even bother that because, you know, it doesn't matter somehow. And I think that's the troubling state we're in.
I'm talking with Kevin Young, and he's the author of the book Bunk, The Rise of Hoaxes, Humbug, Plagiarists, Phonies, Post-Facts, and Fake News. And what should a listener do with this information now? You want us to be more wary, more savvy, and then what? What do we do?
Well, I think we have to be cautious, but not cynical, because in a weird way, the cynicism, the belief that, say, everything is fake, is what's gotten us in this position. I'm someone who directs a library, the Schomburg Center in Harlem, part of the New York Public Library, and I think libraries are a great place to start. I mean, it sounds very basic, but in one way, they're the places that through the years, through the generations, and especially now, keep the records of our time. You know, they are the ones on the front lines thinking about information, what's good information, what sources are. And you can find lots of things, as I did working on this book, at the library and in archives. I also think we have to, you know, be a bit generous with each other and listen to each other rather than simply believe the worst about each other, which someone else is telling us about.
Yeah, that's a powerful hoax that makes you want to believe something about the other tribe that makes you feel better about yourself. Kevin Young, writer and archivist at the New York Library Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, and the new book is Bunk. Kevin, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to The Record, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Allison Bruzek, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer is Bree Ripley. I'm Bill Radke. Tomorrow, it's The Week in Review, hosted this week by Ross Reynolds. He'll get you smart about the week's news with help from Essex Porter, Joni Balter, and Emily Parkhurst. I hope you'll tune in.